Okay, I'd like to welcome you to the Market Street Room. You are in section 125. The Religious Construction of Ethical Identity, the Case of the Mormons. I'd like to request that if any of you have any noisemakers, pagers, phones, beepers, as courtesy to the speaker and those around you, that you put those on a particular setting that won't be an inconvenience to those around you or to the speakers. We're going to have a presenter and a respondent today. Our presenter is here from Seattle. Her name is Rachel Morris. Rachel Morris has a master's degree in comparative religion from the University of Washington. She also has a bachelor's degree in physics from the University of Washington. And she has also presented "You Shall Be Hated of All Nations, Conflict in Religious Identity Formation, Comparing Evangelical and Mormon Uses of Conflict for the Pacific Northwest AARP Conference in 2005 in Seattle." So she's been out there making presentations of her writings. And we'd like to go ahead and turn the time over to her.
Just to start off, I have a couple words about the terminology that I choose to use in the paper. I choose to use the word Mormon and Mormon Church in this paper because the term Latter-day Saint is exclusive to members of the Salt Lake City-based church. While I will be focusing on a particular movement which would become the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and you'll see that happen in the paper, and I apologize more of that. If I had more time, I'd make a better distinction there. When dealing with the myths and founding myths and history of many different Mormon organizations, I did not find it appropriate to be exclusive in my terminology. So with that being said, I'll just launch into my paper. The lines between ethnic identity and religion are often blurred. In what sense can Jewishness be considered an ethnic identity, and to what degree is it related to the religion Judaism? These boundary cases are useful for investigating what is meant by ethnicity and how those identities are constructed, especially when there is no obvious racial marker involved. I will investigate a case in which ethnicity was constructed from the ground up using a unique theological system and the common cultural stories of it. Charles Keyes identifies ethnic identity as a sense of shared heritage signified through cultural attributes such as stories, ceremonies, and commemorations. These elements abound in my case study as a group united through a sense of special peoplehood and chosenness, a sense of shared blood and lineage, and is oriented to a sacred land, all of which was reiterated and made concrete through shared ritual and practice, and hardened through the common experiences of tribulation. These people were the Mormons, who in the course of constructing their religion began to see themselves as special descendants meant to congregate together on chosen land, naturally attracted to each other as they believed that they shared a common bloodline beforehand unknown to them. This talk explores the religious rhetoric which created a people, the common experience which strengthened that identity, and the factors which diminished it in the last century. When the Mormon Church was first created by Joseph Smith in 1830 in upstate New York, it did not significantly differ from the myriad of other movements springing up during the Second Great Awakening. Its students came primarily from Joseph's claim to prophethood, and that he had uncovered, with the help of an angel, the records of an ancient people who had lived on the American continent, which explained the descendancy of the Native Americans then living there. This book, the Book of Mormon, would prove to be the first source of Mormon fascination with lineage. As trace the history of Jews originating from Israel, coming to the Americas in response to prophetic call, and subsequently being formed into two groups, the Lamanites and the Nephites. The Nephites were the descendants of the righteous bunch, and so remained white and delightsome. And the Lamanites of a disobedient one, and because of their disobedience, were cursed with a dark skin. Eventually, the British Lamanites destroyed the more civilized Nephites, and hence the descendants of the Native Americans are revealed. Perhaps surprisingly, this discourse caused Mormons special interest in Native Americans as important targets for converts, because although they may have strayed from God's ways, they were still considered descendants of Israel, and therefore bringing them into the fold had eschatological overtones. Some of the first Mormon missions were then targeted at the Native Americans, a source of tension as Mormons migrated to Missouri, and whites saw their interest in Native Americans as a potential source of violence. Mormon overtures to North American Natives were never particularly successful, but that never stopped at least symbolic gestures to convert them. These efforts were, until a few decades ago, often coupled with stories claiming that their skin color becomes fairer with conversion, proof that the Book of Mormon curse is being lifted, and that they are slowly being integrated as righteous members of Mormon society. Although there is no obvious unique marker of Mormon ethnic identity, whiteness surely was an expected characteristic. The Native American missionary impulse was possibly one of the catalysts for greater theological development focused on lineage. During Joseph's time, there was great interest in the fate of the so-called 10 lost tribes of Israel. One popular doctrine placed the descendants of these lost tribes in Europe and then specifically in Great Britain. No doubt Joseph was influenced by this because later successful missions were directed at Europe and the missionaries increasingly used this Israelite lineage-oriented language to attract potential converts there. Since Joseph was ordained by God to restore the one and only true church, naturally Israel would be the primary focus. Therefore, the theological justification for Joseph's calling as prophet of God and restorer of the true church. Joseph began to understand himself as a literal descendant of Joseph of old, the son of Israel that then included his family. In a reenactment of Old Testament themes, he instituted patriarchal blessings, a practice that continues to this day. The first patriarch was his father, and members of the church would go to be blessed by him, given certain admonitions and encouragement. As Joseph understood himself and his family to be from an ancient Israelite lineage, his father began to declare members of his family as part of the lineage of Ephraim, as part of their blessing, known through divine inspiration. It is not clear to what extent this was taken literally at first, but as the practice developed, it was extended beyond Joseph's family to other church members, and the lineage declaration was then understood literally. Those of Ephraim tended to be white members and were understood to be part of the overall leadership of the future kingdom of God when Jesus returns. The other popular declaration was that of Manasseh. Those designated tended to be natives who would have a subordinate role in the building of the kingdom. Parallel to these developments was a further inspiration from the Old Testament, the desire to name the sacred land. Many Mormons had been congregating together upon conversion in Ohio to be close to their prophet, but it was not understood as a sacred site. Jerusalem was kept as one sacred site for the house of Judah, and was commonly known as the Jews, but a new sacred site is needed for the rest of Israel and the restored Church of Christ. No doubt inspired by the American-centric focus of the Book of Mormon, the site of ancient Eden was revealed to be located in Missouri through prophetic revelation and the site of Jesus' second coming. Mormons were further required by God through revelation to obtain that land and build up a city there. They set to this work purchasing land and creating a settlement while having a secondary settlement remain in Kirkland, Ohio. The Mormons soon became unwelcome to the established settlers' intentions rose. Meanwhile, things reached a boiling point in Ohio, and the Mormon population there was forced to resettle in Missouri, only stoking the flames more. Eventually, the Mormons were forcibly removed in 1838 at the behest of the infamous Mormon extermination order given by the governor, and Joseph was arrested and held in squalor for months. Despite great prophetic revelation forbidding the Mormons to let go of their sacred land, it was seized from them and they were forced to regroup elsewhere. They found an initially friendly environment in Illinois, where they emptied a swamp and built a new city named by Joseph Nauvoo, based on his knowledge of Hebrew. The site of Missouri never lost sacred importance, and various outgrowths of the Mormon movement contest still for ownership of that land. The Mormons increasingly had reason to parallel their experience with their ancient brethren as recorded in the Old Testament. They had prophets, were driven from their divinely appointed lands, and they too had sacred laws revealed to them by which they were to build a theocratic kingdom. In Nauvoo, they regularly conflated civil and religious authority, as Joseph was both mayor, head of their city's militia, and president and prophet of their church. Not surprisingly, outsiders began to regret their decision to welcome the Mormons, particularly if they formed briefly the largest city in Illinois and had the potential to outvote native Illinoisans. Meanwhile, Joseph found further inspiration from his Old Testament ancestors, and it was revealed to him that he was to build a temple. A temple was built in Ohio, and one was barely begun in Missouri, but these were no more than glorified meeting halls. Having recently joined the Masons, Joseph used his abilities at syncretism and developed elaborate rituals that Mormons would undergo in the new Nauvoo temple. One of these was baptisms for the dead. Concerned for those in his family who died before they could join God's true church, Joseph received a revelation in which it was made known to him that the dead lived on in spirit form, but bodiless spirits could not go through the necessary ritual baptism. Hence, the living would be baptized in the names of dead relatives, so that the deceased could partake of the saving ritual and enjoy the blessings of the highest degree of glory in heaven. Through this means, Joseph could concretize the links with his family, and he sought to extend his family through another revealed practice, plural marriage. It is not entirely clear how many women Joseph ended up marrying, perhaps around 20. These women were not just married to Joseph until death did them part. They understood that by being eternally sealed to Joseph through the proper ceremony, they would be his wives and thus guaranteed the highest salvation for eternity. Through this means, Joseph extended his lineage and connected himself further to his church. Likewise, many of his most intimate circle did likewise. The sense of peoplehood was further concretized through these ceremonies, which the Mormons partook in even after Joseph was killed in 1844 and while they were being driven from Illinois. Many hurried to complete the temple in order to perform these ceremonies in the Nauvoo temple before heading further west, fully aware it would be destroyed. Joseph provided a solid sense of unique lineage and land, made real through theology as revealed by prophecy, and reinforced through increasingly elaborate ritual. These also provided Mormons a sense of shared rhetoric and special understanding about the world, as well as a unique way of life which redefined moral norms. They had a theological rhetoric by which to understand their special status as members of Israel, united through the restored Church of Christ, and that Israelite understanding was continuously made real through their daily encounters with a prophet, a temple, a theocratic government, and patriarchal blessings, among other things. For those who stayed, and many did not, the persecution they endured at the hands of unfriendly fellow Americans all increased their sense of solidarity and uniqueness in the world. Rather than reintegrate with the rest of the population, as the murderers of Joseph had hoped, many regrouped and decided to leave the land of liberty altogether. These developments increased as Mormons crossed the prairies to enter their newly designated land from God, and led by their new leader, Brigham Young. The land was designated sacred when Brigham Young entered in the Salt Lake Valley and prophetically declared, "This is the place whereon we will plant our feet and where the Lord's people will dwell." Here, Mormons would remain relatively unmolested for only a short while, but they maintained some degree of autonomy for decades, through the church law, that is prophetic law, the law of the land. Theological developments during the time between settling the future of Utah in 1896, when Utah was made a state, further enriched Mormon ethnic identity. One important understanding was one they carried with them from the East. The unbelieving outsiders were Gentiles. Though they were true Israelites, the Jews amongst them. Because of their unbelieving blood, Gentiles found it much more difficult to respond to the message of the gospel, and thus resorted to violence when dealing with the truth Mormons presented. Those who were able to convert were often understood to have believing blood, that is, literal Israelite blood, which made their conversion likely. Occasionally, a true-blooded Gentile was open up to the Holy Ghost to accept the gospel. In that case, their baptism was often accompanied by violent physical gestures pointed at an inward change, as their blood was literally changed to Israelite blood. The convert could then visit the church patriarch, who could reveal to the person his or her specific new Israelite lineage. To re-emphasize their status as Israelite, he could visit one of the temples of God, by which Mormon cities were oriented, and help to make the new promised land blossom through his labor. He might even feel called to take on plural wives, a means through which he could feel his status as Israelite patriarch of his large family more concretely. The development of the doctrine of the premarital existence also had an impact on ethnic understanding. The seeds of this theology were firmly planted by Joseph, but fully blossomed after his death. According to this doctrine, the core of every person is inherently eternal, but this core, the intelligence of the person, is progressively clothed. First, it's clothed with a spirit body, essentially physical, but made of much finer matter than regular matter. This process was accomplished when God the Father and God the Mother created a spirit body, which was then inhabited by one of these eternal intelligences. After creating many of these, the non spirits were told that if they were to progress even farther, they needed to take on physical bodies, but that could only be done at grave danger to themselves. By entering the physical world to take on bodies, they would necessarily open themselves up to temptations, which would cut them off to the presence of God. One of these spirits, named Lucifer, proposed that freedom of will, or free agency, be taken and the danger thus removed. The oldest of these spirits, Jesus, proposed that he would provide a sacrifice for the inevitable mistakes the spirits would make, thus retaining free agency, and yet providing a means for the spirits to return to God after their mortal lives end. The winner of God's approval, of course, was Jesus, which sent Lucifer into a rage. He persuaded a third of the spirits to fall on him into a war against the rest of the spirits, in which he unsurprisingly lost. It became understood that the most valiant of spirits in the premortal realm were those who were born into Mormon families and who became Mormon leaders. Hence, premortal valiancy could determine moral lineage, which added moral justification to the differentiation. For example, it became commonly understood that blacks are black because they were less valid or even neutral in this war. Hence, they were cursed with dark skin, and the Lamanites were cursed with dark skin on the mortal earth. This myth, which is often used to emphasize the common heritage of humanity and the spiritual, literal brotherhood of humankind, has often been used as a justification for exclusion and forming a toxic link between visible skin color and inherent spiritual worthiness. For Mormons to understand themselves as belonging to people not only unique, but of people inherently spiritually superior to others, proved to be a doctrine difficult to emphasize as it began to enter mainstream American culture. As the United States expanded its interests, it was only a matter of time before the Mormons felt the pressure of its military. Given a brief reprieve during the Civil War, attention was brought to the then territory of Utah, in which theocracy reigned supreme, and most horrifically, the outsiders' polygamy abounded. Eventually, after having many leaders arrested and the U.S. Army on the brink of an all-out battle with them, Mormons gave in, and in 1890, the then-prophet president of the church Wilfred Woodruff received a revelation officially ending the practice of polygamy. With that proclamation began the Mormon reintegration with the greater American society, which slowly eroded much of their peoplehood. Utah became a state in 1896 and began to seek political respectability as they struggled to seek their Mormon choices to Congress, which meant downplaying much of their uniqueness and replacing it with an overall emphasis on personal moral behavior. They also expanded their mission again, this time beyond their European brethren. Having great success among non-Europeans and non-North American natives, they expanded their understanding of who could qualify as a Lamanite, and hence a natural Israelite and proper inheritor of the gospel. As that project attested the imagination, eventually the need to make that identification, a Lamanite, in order to have a justified mission diminished. Along with it, a sense of importance surrounding lineage more generally. With the coming of the Civil Rights Movement, more trouble was ahead for the Mormons as it took aim to pressure the church to rescind its long-standing prohibition against blacks holding the priesthood. With the division of the world into Israelites and Gentiles, one group that proved troubling to the label was the blacks. Like many Americans at the time, in the 19th century, Mormons generally understood blacks to be under the curse of Cain and Ham. And that understanding was only reinforced by the mythology of the premortal existence, as discussed earlier. As a result, those with provable African lineage were denied the priesthood, which was difficult to swallow, considering that every Mormon male is eligible to receive the priesthood, and almost all do. It's not clear how this practice got started, since there's a well-documented case of Joseph permitting the ordination of a black man, Elijah Abel, to the priesthood in 1836, and that he was subsequently given a leadership position. The practice was most clearly delineated during Brigham Young's leadership, who actually asked Elijah Abel to refrain from using the priesthood he was ordained with earlier. Sometime during this period, the practice became official policy and was an outgrowth of Mormons linking their special ethnicity with the appearance of whiteness. Apparently, blacks were just too black to become fair, as the Native Americans appeared to do. So how could they become full members of their people? This also makes sense considering Mormon ethnic identity reached its pinnacle clarity during the same period. However, that blacks could join at all revealed the means through which Mormons could later downplay their earlier ethnic consciousness through a focus on the religion of Mormonism as a universal gospel promoting moral worthiness. Not surprisingly, the church came under fire for its exclusivist practice, yet held out until 1978, at which time the then prophet Spencer Kimball had a revelation finally allowing all Mormon members to receive the priesthood. Who, by the way, in 1960 commented on the fair skin of believing natives. The official reason for the ban in the first place was left as an unknown, and a major barrier to great expansion in Africa as well as South America, where many members had African descendants, was finally lifted. Now missionaries would no longer be concerned with matters of lineage when targeting converts. As a result, it was estimated in 1988, about a decade after the revelation, that there were some 125,000 to 200,000 black Mormon members worldwide, who have done a giant leap for a church with a membership in the millions, but at least an importance of all of them. Mormonism as the gospel for the Israelites became metaphorical. The body of the church is now mostly the metaphorical Israel. Patriarchal blessings still designate an Israelite lineage, but those are now largely understood as metaphorical identity, not literal blood in most cases. Another changing response to global growth was the correlation movement. The church in the mid-20th century found itself overseeing members around the world and decided to tighten the managerial reins. Sunday school and other auxiliary groups would now be directly overseen by Salt Lake City, and all would teach from the same manuals carefully crafted by an official committee. As a result, The volunteer spirit that Mormons once fostered was undermined as the church imposed increasingly bureaucratic means of management. While the church became more bureaucratic and the intense participation of communal life diminished, ironically, it was a move made in an attempt to protect Mormon teaching and culture from being diluted as it was exported. The new visible signs of being a Mormon shifted from irrigating the desert, building neatly organized towns, and planting crops in the promised land in the 19th century, to personal behaviors such as not drinking coffee and paying a tithe in the 20th century, which do not have connotations of literal communal kingdom building. Once again, the emphasis on a universal gospel for all people eroded the fabric of Mormon uniqueness, even if as an unintended result. Another strong current, strengthened by the efficient oversight provided by the Correlation Movement, was the Mormon desire to be seen as respectable. In the 19th century, Mormonism was seen as quintessentially anti-American, fostering immoral behavior, evidenced through polygamy, and anti-democracy and its theocracy. As Mormons rose on the socioeconomic ladder in the 20th century and migrated away from the Mormon corridor, they sought to overturn that image as they had a greater stake in the American system. The leadership of the latter be seen as respectable. In the 19th century, Mormonism was seen as quintessentially anti-American, fostering immoral behavior, evidenced through polygamy, and anti-democracy and its theocracy. As Mormons rose on the socioeconomic ladder in the 20th century and migrated away from the Mormon corridor, they sought to overturn that image as they had a greater stake in the American system. The leadership responded through sophisticated marketing to polish the Mormon image into preeminently American, clean-cut, and hard-working, even through the turbulent 1960s. A series of official Mormon publications in the 1980s showed a decrease of distinctly Mormon themes discussed, such as Zion, eschatology, the apostasy of other churches, the corruption of the outside government, and an increase of themes such as the greatness of America, patriotism, good citizenship, and the universal Christian gospel as the 20th century progressed. Along these same lines, the temple ceremony was shortened and the most serving elements removed. The temple garment that the sheikh is required to wear after going through the ceremony is shortened, and related to this change was a downplay of the uniquely Mormon point of view about the nature of God in favor of a more mainstream Christian one. Examples of theological shifts are numerous, but the main theme is a move away from Mormon theological uniqueness to a more normative Protestant position. The desire for public respectability as Mormons integrated into the wider American society also had the end effect of eroding Mormon uniqueness. Despite accommodations made to the larger American culture, Mormons have not proven particularly friendly to accommodating the cultures they otherwise missionized. One example is the 1989 freeze by the Ghanaian government on all Mormon church activities, later rescinded, as evidence their temple was recently built there. Subsequent newspaper articles published in Ghana reflected suspicion of the Mormons as possible American spies due to their display of wealth in their new buildings, cars, and formerly dressed missionaries in ties and jackets, which led them to believe they were CIA agents. Similarly, they were nearly forced to close down their Brigham Young University Center in Jerusalem when it became an object of Orthodox Jewish suspicion in 1985, and Mormon buildings were subjected to bomb threats. Ultimately, Mormons were able to negotiate these problems, but the connection of Mormonism to proselytizing and Americanism continues to cause occasional problems, as Mormon missionaries still wear slacks and ties, and all ultimately must heed to the authority residing in Salt Lake City. Whether in Ghana, Brazil, or Utah, the same Sunday school lesson will be heard, hymns sung from the same hymn book, to order her piano music, and the same standards of dress observed for men who serve in official position. It would seem then that Mormon accommodation to other cultures has a limit. While accommodating to the larger American culture, Mormons want all Mormons to do it together in a similar fashion, whether residing in the United States or not. While the correlation movement may have eroded elements of Mormonism that give it a sense of ethnicity, such as the building up of a literal promised land and Israelite blood, it grew out of an impulse sprouted from that same ethnicity, the desire that all Mormons everywhere share a similar culture. If Mormons had not felt the compulsion to spread their religion, and had not found themselves increasingly a part of the American socioeconomic structure they once criticized, no doubt their ethnic identity would remain intact. The vestiges of a once solid sense of ethnic identity remain in ritual practice, since and in Mormon rhetoric, but without the sense of literal meaning behind them, can no longer be understood to mark an actual ethnicity. The sense of sacred land remains, as they are focused on the Salt Lake Valley as a central locale and residence of the prophet leader. But no longer are outsiders called Gentiles, and all can join a Mormon enterprise without a violent change in blood. Through this case study, I have come to better understand contemporary Mormon policies and activities, better awareness that the Mormons share a history of ethnic unity, now threatened by the impulse built into the core of their theology to proselytize to the world. Perhaps the difference between the Jewish case I mentioned in the introduction and the Mormons is precisely that. Mormons are compelled to spread their religion, and Judaism is content to make conversion restrictive, better protecting the ethnic nature of Jewishness. Also, this case study illuminates the nature of ethnicity, how quickly the identity can be built when the shared bond is understood to have been established in the prehistoric times of Abraham, and even before the world was created, and when it is reenacted in a new promised land. Even if that the shared blood, the foreign known, created through rhetoric, can be realized. This case reveals the dynamics between behind ethnicity making and cloaking how the identities of humans often take for granted as givens are just as often nothing more than human creations.
Thank you, Rachel. Our respondent is going to be Francis Nelson Henderson. And Mr. Henderson was born into the church in Raleigh, North Carolina. He served a mission to Southern California. He graduated with a bachelor's in physics from BYU in 1968. He was married in the temple, and he is a founding member of Comtel in 1978, and that is a satellite communications company where his focus was software development. And he is remarried, and him and his family live near San Diego, California. And I'll turn the time over to him.
Thank you. And thank you, Rachel. I thoroughly enjoyed reading Rachel's speech in preparation for this reply. And perhaps if you'd like to have a copy, maybe you could speak to her afterwards. Her footnotes are quite good. It's an easy read. I love the way that Rachel, who is a church member, has courageously and fearlessly spoken the truth here. Much of what she has said for me in my time, a former generation, were very sensitive issues. The issue of the Negro and the priesthood and many other things that she has touched on are things that would not have been so easy for me to speak about back then, back in the 70s.
Speak into the mic.
Lift
it up a little bit. There you go.
She knows her Mormon history well. That's quite astonishing for someone so young. To me, at least, I was much older when I learned many of the things that she spoke of. She weaves this very nicely into an account of Mormon ethnic identity. And it is true that we have an identity. Mormons even have a Mormon accent. On several occasions, I've been able to identify people in California and in Nevada who I said, you know, this is a Latter-day Saint. And all three of my four children sprang from their chairs and ran to the restroom when I said, I'm sure that our waiter here is Latter-day Saint, and I'm going to ask her. And when the waitress came back, indeed she was. Racism is, or race is, a component of ethnic identity, and I love the way that Rachel spoke about that. She identifies what she calls a racial marker linking Mormonism to their special ethnicity, to the appearance of whiteness, that being a race. As a missionary and being transferred from Prescott, Arizona to Flagstaff, Arizona, I took occasion to read this little book, Mormonism and the Negro, and it introduced me to the Rachel calls the toxic identification that premortal deity is the link between skin color and inherent spiritual worthiness. That's quite a courageous statement to be made, I think. And although church leaders have removed the priesthood restriction from blacks and changed the wording in the Book of Mormon describing the Lamanites' racial curse, they have not yet renounced the underlying theological racist beliefs that undergird that former those former ethnic or racial views. And hence it is that my grandchildren, who are not 100% European Americans, white European Americans, at some time in their lives, almost certainly will hear of this idea that there is something inherently defective or deficient in their spirituality inherited from their former life. There is a gentleman named William Call who wrote a book entitled A Cultural Revolution, and he ignores the issue of race and deals with Mormon culture. But he notices much of what Rachel spoke of. There was a time in the church, in the times of David O. McKay and perhaps before, when there was an emphasis on the Enlightenment, on libertarian values, on freedom, and the freedom of agency. Church members had a higher, had more freedom to speak their views within the church. He longs for the return to that. He noticed this shift as the Correlation Committee and as the authoritarians in power within the church began to move the church more towards a communal emphasis as opposed to the individualistic emphasis that existed earlier. I think he's given up. Bishop John Shelby Spong, an author, Episcopal author, touches on some of the issues that Rachel talks about. He discusses the ancient tribal mentality in which the Israelites believed that God favored them, but not the Babylonians, or favored the Israelite children above and beyond the Egyptian firstborn. And likewise, we Mormons in our ethnic construction believe that we're special and different. We believe that God has special blessings for us that he doesn't have for those who are outside of our community. And such elitist tribal views once held act, I believe, to separate God's children one from another. Rachel's paper is descriptive as opposed to prescriptive. She concludes, I love her conclusion here, I'll read that to you. She concludes saying, "In this case reveals the dynamics behind ethnicity making, uncloaking how the identities humans often take for granted as given are just often nothing more than human creations." So with that, I want to thank Rachel for her fine paper, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'll turn the time back over to our chairperson.
Thank you for your response. We're going to open up the floor for questions now. And also our presenter, respondent, can also converse with each other. There's no rule against that. And I'd like to ask people who have questions to come on up to the microphone and ask your question, and then whoever's going to be responding it to come here so it can be recorded.
Yes, I am of the passing interest in this topic. This topic that I've been interested in myself for a long time, and I walked into the room just a bit late, and I'm asking you to repeat something you said at the beginning. I guess two questions. Number one, I assume this must be part of a larger study, or is this just something that you did on the side? It said that you have an MA in comparative religion. I guess you were using Judaism and Mormonism, kind of using that as a point of comparison. Is that what it was, a larger study in the context of that? And then on dealing with the construction of a Mormon ethnic identity, how is your if it's part of a larger study, how will it differ from, let's say, the work of Armin Mosch, you know, all of Abraham's children? Those are basically the two questions.
Sure. Actually, the paper was a result of a class seminar that I took about ethnicity and religion. So it was a result of a lot of dialogue with my peers and other things I wrote during that course. But I didn't, the actual paper, I didn't actually have a larger piece on Judaism, though. That would be a good idea. Your second question, I actually drew heavily from Armin Mosch in my paper, and you can see that in my footnoting. So I'm not sure how much of a point of difference there would actually be, to be honest.
I walked in a little way too, you may have answered this, but how do you account for the anti-LDS feeling in the world? Mormons aren't Christians. And when George Romney ran for president, there wasn't this anti-Mormon attitude toward his candidacy. Of course, he wasn't in it as long as there is for Mitt Romney. When I served a mission in Virginia and North Carolina in the 1950s, I didn't run into that at all. It was more apathy than anything. Mm-hmm. My grandson returned from a mission not too long ago and ran into a lot of anti-Mormon sentiment. Why the difference?
I think that's a great question. I think it actually has to do with not so much Mormonism in this case, but the resurgence of evangelical Christianity, which has really taken off in the last several decades. So in the 50s and 60s, Mormons were seen as actually predominantly American, Kalinka, especially as the 60s came through and there's the hippie movements and things like that. Gave Mormonism an edge in the PR department, but since the rise of, or the re-rise of evangelical Christianity, I should say, it's taken aim at Mormonism.
I think as a policy, the church is marketing itself as any corporation would. It's hired PR campaign, corporations and whatnot, to the point that the prophet of the church disavows central doctrine on national television. The 60-minute interview with Mike Wallace, I believe it was, when he was asked about becoming gods, and he says, "I've heard that preached before. I don't know much about it." Whereas any 8-year-old kid, the church could tell a prophet all about it. I think as an adjunct study, you might look into contemporary marketing of the church with its highly centered, family-oriented, and disavowal of fundamental Mormon doctrine. I'm wondering, perhaps your next bit of study could go towards looking on the inside workings of the modern contemporary church and its attempt to broaden what it has to do, because, you know, small religious peculiar organizations cannot survive. They will always remain small, like the polygamists, like the Hutterites, like these separatist groups that will always remain small, because they do have peculiar, difficult doctrines to accept. And for the church to continue to grow, it has to homogenize and turn its doctrine upside down to make it so that it's very acceptable for a broader scope of people to accept. So my challenge, I guess, to you, if you haven't already thought about it, is to look into the modern contemporary church and see what inside workings are currently going on to make that happen.
All right, so I guess we have 10 comments on that, so I guess I'll go first. First of all, there's definitely room for exploration in the paper, taking it deeper into exactly how Mormonism, as if you look at a product, is packaged and presented to potential converts, because, you know, I'm certain there are sociologists and experts at this, advertising, etc., who are behind the image the church is attempting to portray to the world now. The other part of that I often think about is, to what extent can Mormonism afford to erode its unique identity and still be thriving and strong? Because if it becomes just another Protestant denomination, it has to compete with all of the other popular Protestant evangelical churches that are out there, the Pentecostal movement and everyone else. And quite frankly, based on my knowledge of sacrament meetings, they may not do that well. So I think part of what helps it is actually maintaining some sense of uniqueness. So it'll be interesting to see where that balance is struck to maximize convert potential.
I have the suspicion that Mormonism is weak, that this emphasis on testimony, the emphasis on obedience, and all of this weakens us, that it makes us robotic, that we need the dialogue. We need what Sunstone offers. We need the freedom to speak publicly our conscience. That this type of pluralism can be what does change the church, what does move it forward. And it's, I think we're stuck. And I think that at some point that the King's New Clothes, we're going to know. So I will, anyhow, that's my recommendation. Pluralistic, open, freedom of speech, the Mormon way is, as Armin Moss says, you know, we don't say publicly what it is we think. We do this in private. But no, speak, we speak freely, and we do, and we honor and respect the views of all of us and all of our opinions. Yes, it's not going to be pretty. The image might be tarnished, but that we have to have an underlying core strength. And this image making doesn't give us that. I think we're weak.
My question is, what do you think of the fundamentalist claim that in 1860 President John Taylor, 1886, had an 8-hour meeting in which he prophesied that the many doctrines and practices of the church would be changed by future presidents? And he set apart a council of men who were ordained to be apostles and patriarchs who would see to it that none of these things were changed in the future, that the truth and practices remained the same. And that's my question. Are you aware of that?
Well, I think that's a classic case of sedge-making, which is pretty typical, where the leader of the new sect or the group will challenge the main body, usually by saying that it's gone astray, that its teachings are no longer the original true teachings, and so forth. So there are dozens of Mormon sects, and they're all, you know, there's usually some story like this, since the idea of personal revelation and priesthood authorities is ingrained in what Mormonism is. So I'm not sure how to further answer that question, if I think the prophecy is being answered or not. Well, all religions change. This is not uncommon.
I've been struggling to try to find out why ethnicity is an issue in the church. And the thing that jumps in my mind, it's a fascinating topic, but what caused it, and it strikes me, and I'd like you to respond to this, Rachel. If there's an effect, what is the cause? And the cause seems to me, just off the top of my head, that it's a response to negative ethnicity. Brother, you agree with Robert Matthews? A radical early 19th century prophet, where he did the same thing, we're all Israelites, and I'm really an incarnation of the prophet, an early apostle. So in other words, early Mormonism as a suppressed ethnicity, the suppressed the Lamanites. So what I'm suggesting here is ethnicity as a response to cultural forces where people are suppressed.
Okay.
Is that what's going on here, or why is this happening if that's not the case?
Yeah, I think there have been several scholars who have looked at Mormonism as a response of suppressed people, in that they don't really fit the socioeconomic order in America that well, or they didn't when it was formed. Specifically looking at Joseph Smith, how his family was so downwardly moral that perhaps by carving out a new identity, they could recreate for themselves a place where they really belong and thrive. So that's certainly one possibility as to why this happened. And my favorite, I didn't theorize so much on the core reasons why this happened, but that's a possibility, that the people who joined and were attracted to this just didn't quite belong in the wider society. Was that your question? Okay.
I enjoyed your paper very much, and I've always felt a member of the tribe of Mormonism. I